Welcome back to Uprising. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. News reports emerged early this week that the head of the Islamic State group, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, was so seriously injured in an airstrike in western Iraq that he no longer oversees the day-to-day control of the organization. It is the third such report of a strike assumed to have injured al-Baghdadi. But this time, two separate anonymous sources have confirmed the injury. The U.S.-led war on ISIS has sought to extend the same approach that it took against al-Qaeda, focused airstrikes aimed at so-called high-value targets. But the war seems not to have blunted the Islamic State's brutality. 30 Ethiopian Christians were shown to be beheaded and shot in videos recently released by ISIS. The victims were referred to as crusaders by ISIS soldiers. Meanwhile, here in the United States, a very different type of accountability for terrorist acts is playing out. A jury in April convicted Dzhokhar Tsarnaev of all 30 counts for which he was charged for his role in the Boston Marathon bombing that killed three people and injured hundreds. A sentencing trial has just begun, during which jurors were shown a photo of Tsarnaev showing his middle finger to the camera after being captured. The photo is intended to make the case that he remained, quote, unrepentant, even after being arrested. A debate is now underway on whether he should receive the death penalty. My guest is Amir A. Nasser. He's a writer and educator. He's the author of My Islam, How Fundamentalism Stole My Mind and Doubt Freed My Soul. His article about ISIS was widely read. It was entitled, ISIS Isn't the Real Enemy, the Game of Thrones Medieval Mindset That Birthed It Is. Welcome to Uprising, Amir.
Thank you for having me.
Well, first, before we turn to Dzhokhar Tsarnaev and what's playing out here on U.S. soil, let's talk about ISIS and the latest situation in the northern Iraq-Syria region. How important is it for the U.S. to make an example of Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi? He seems to have become the new Osama bin Laden, and the killing of bin Laden when that happened was considered this great Western triumph over fundamentalism.
Well, I think, first of all, it's important to state and to acknowledge that we need to hold criminals and terrorists accountable for their actions. So that goes without saying, really. And yes, in a sense, you know, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi is sort of like a new Osama bin Laden. And, you know, thankfully, Osama bin Laden was eliminated. And I think we can look at that only as a military triumph because we took out the head of al-Qaeda. However, is it really a triumph over fundamentalism? Is it really a triumph over the ideology? Frankly, I don't think so. You can take out the leaders of these organizations, you can hurt them and maim them, but if the ideology is still there, if the factors that gave rise to these groups are still there, then it's not a triumph.
What do you make of the recent beheadings and shootings of Ethiopian Christians? This has not received very much attention in the U.S., although Pope Francis did strongly denounce the killings. And I'm wondering if the propaganda effect that ISIS is looking for through these barbaric videotaped killings might be waning. Or is it just that Ethiopians are, you know, not considered as important? It's easier to overlook them because, of course, these are Black Africans.
Well, I think it's three things. Mm-hmm. I think, yes, I do think that the shock factor of these videos is generally waning. Two, yes, I think that there is some truth to the fact, you know, unfortunately, like we've seen it repeatedly again and again, and there does seem to be a pattern that, you know, the deaths of Black Africans tend to be ignored by, you know, general global media. And, you know, maybe we can say, you know, part of it is just, well, nobody really cares, and it maybe it's a soft form of racism. But I think the bigger reason is it's just that, you know, when the victims are Western, you know, it's really Western media that tends to be very globally prominent. And so, you know, Western media will pay attention to Western narratives that are of interest to Western audiences. And so, you know, I think that's part of the bigger reason is just how the media dynamics really work. But, you know, despite, you know, having said that, the killings really have had a very, very terrible effect within Ethiopian communities. So even though, you know, these videos might have a waning effect, you know, for the communities and the families of the victims, it's just a very, very horrible ordeal. I mean, the amount of grief, the outpouring of grief that was featured, you know, in footage from Ethiopia is just extremely heartbreaking.
And so let's talk about the fact that if al-Baghdadi is incapacitated either through injury or through death, if he is outright killed, what impact would that actually have on ISIS? I mean, I can't imagine that it would necessarily deter them.
Yes, I completely agree with you. It will have hardly any kind of impact. I mean, if you just look at, you know, the investigative reports that have been carried out by the New York Times and the German press, and even the Arabic press, it's just, you know, he's a figurehead. Really, that's what he is primarily. And he was selected because he has a PhD in Islamic studies from the University of, you know, Baghdad. And therefore, you know, he would just kind of grant the movement sort of a religious legitimacy that they're trying to establish. But he's mostly a figurehead, and it wouldn't have any impact on them. And if he dies, they'll just declare him as a martyr, replace him with a new figurehead. And, you know, the show will continue because there still are many military generals who used to be part of Saddam Hussein's army and who are now part of ISIS who are really running the show. And they're the real masterminds and the ones who are very capable.
Now, in your widely read piece, which was published last summer entitled ISIS Isn't the Real Enemy, you say, quote, even if ISIS is militarily defeated in the short term, the mindset that helped birth it has become far too common. And so following up on what you were just saying, what do you specifically mean by that mindset?
Yeah, thank you for asking that question. You know, it's a quote, so let me just give a bigger context for that quote. When I say the mindset has become far too common, I don't mean the mindset of killing and destroying and maiming, you know, the actual terrorizing. But what I refer to in that piece is the mindset of people who want to see the removal of man-made secular law, the banishment of man-made secular law, and the establishment or return to God's original pure law. There are many mindsets that do wish to see a return to what's in Arabic called al-Khilaf, or in English, the caliphate, which, you know, has been getting all sorts of attention. There are a lot of people who want to see that. And do they necessarily support the methodologies of ISIS? I would say the majority, you know, definitely no. But there are many who are sympathetic. And if you look at Saudi Arabia, I mean, Saudi Arabia beheads people, you know, publicly for all sorts of capital offenses. Saudi Arabia chops off hands for thievery. I mean, these are the punishments that we're criticizing ISIS for, yet Saudi Arabia is an American ally. And, you know, the criticism is mum. You know, and these things, these mindsets are present, not in all of Saudi society, but certainly in certain segments, and they're considered normative. And so that's extremely troubling, because once you support the establishment of the caliphate and you want to see a return to pure religious law and you support these kind of really, you know, nasty medieval punishments, then that's really the first step. And when you become very fervent and passionate about that, and other factors come into play, you know, that could cross over into support for groups of like ISIS or participation in groups like ISIS.
Let's turn to the trial of Dzhokhar Tsarnaev. He was convicted, I mentioned earlier in the month, of all 30 counts for which he was charged. And this is a very different scenario that's unfolding in terms of accountability for a terrorist act. And you mentioned earlier in our conversation that, of course, we do have to hold perpetrators of violence and criminals accountable. And I'm wondering what you make of the assertion by Tsarnaev's defense as the trial was playing out that this young man was influenced by his older brother Tamerlan, who was killed during the pursuit. How easy is it to be seduced by fundamentalist ideology?
Yeah, well, I think, first of all, I'd like to state that, you know, the American justice system is not perfect. It's far from perfect. But just the very fact that, you know, Tsarnaev has a defense team and they can defend him on his behalf is really a testament to the positive aspects of the American legal system. And it's very impressive in its own right that this kind of trial is happening. You know, it is the right thing to do.
I should just mention very briefly in our critiques of the trial, by the way, the fact that it was held in Massachusetts has come under strong criticism because, of course, of the emotional bias that naturally would exist. But I see your point as well, of course.
Right, definitely. And so, you know, the defense team, of course, has to defend him. It's their job. That's how the whole system is set up. And so, you know, they're going to try their best to reduce the punishment, to make sure that maybe he perhaps doesn't get executed, that he gets a life sentence. Because from the reports that I've read, his lawyer doesn't want to see him get the death sentence. I think it's a she. Mm-hmm. She wants to see him get the, you know, get life in prison. I believe that that's what it is.
And so in terms of the question of how easy it is to be seduced by fundamentalist ideologies, this defense, is this a valid defense? Because when this sort of thing happens, often parents of the children who might be seduced by this type of ideology are caught unawares. Often they're middle class parents, at least, and well-educated families, at least those in the West that might find their children be seduced by some fundamentalist ideology, and it catches them unawares. It can tear a family apart.
Indeed, indeed. And it's an extremely, you know, heartbreaking thing to witness. And, you know, we have to look at radicalization on a case by case basis, frankly. Each case tends to be different. There are some similarities. It's always a combination of very personal grievances and, you know, political and ideological sort of motives. Mm. And so when a mind is vulnerable, when someone feels isolated, has an identity crisis, feels a sense of humiliation because of whatever circumstances he or she went through, and then looks at the outer world and sees the humiliation of Muslims, and they start resonating with that humiliation, and then you bring in fundamentalist ideology into the equation, it's very seductive for a vulnerable mind like that. And so it's a tricky balance because obviously, you know, we can't take away a person's agency and the fact that they make their own decisions at the end of the day. But you are right. Some people tend to be more vulnerable, and therefore the ideology tends to be more seductive for them.
And now, during the sentencing phase of the trial, which is happening this week, the prosecutor is attempting to make the case that Tsarnaev is unrepentant. He was and he's unrepentant. The media are making a big deal about his, quote, defiance. And, of course, this serves to create a hostile reaction among Americans who feel victimized, rightly so, by the Boston Marathon bombing. But it also feeds into this desire to see him executed. But doesn't that just feed the cycle of revenge and hatred?
I think that is a very wise question, and unfortunately, wisdom doesn't come in abundance these days. You are absolutely right. You know, we could execute him, you know, to impose justice or you know, sort of, you know, fulfill a desire for revenge. But at the end of the day, yes, it does feed that cycle of revenge. And, you know, it's not a popular perspective. I think it is really the truth, however. We do perpetuate violence. We do perpetuate this desire for revenge. And at the end of the day, just from a tactical perspective, by executing him, you're making him a martyr. Mm. I think he should be put in prison for life. I frankly hope that during his time in prison, he will come to repent. Finally, he will come to genuinely feel grief and regret for what he's done, and to then perhaps even share his story from behind the prison bars and state that what he did was wrong, and that he would encourage others who are maybe tempted to be radicalized to not go down that path, that it's not worth it, that it's extremely repulsive and appalling, you know, to go down such a path to begin with. That's what I hope the outcome would be. And I do hope that the, you know, families of the victims will find some sort of closure.
We hear constantly of young Muslims being lured by ISIS propaganda, and some people say these reports are vastly inflated. They're small numbers of cases, but still they're inflated in the media. But it's quite difficult for Americans to understand what it is about ISIS barbarism that attracts seemingly, you know, well-educated, rational young people. And so the context, the broader context of how Muslims' oppression is linked to Western policies, of course, is often left out of the equation. But these young folks might be seeing that more clearly. And is that what's attracting them to ISIS propaganda?
Well, certainly. I mean, when such minds, you know, who are vulnerable to radicalization, see the oppression of Muslims and the destruction of Muslim lands, that is definitely a huge, you know, major factor. But I wouldn't only just reduce it to that. Mm-hmm. You know, some just feel a sense of isolation, loneliness, no sense of purpose, a complete lack of meaning in their lives. I mean, if you look at the statements of people who've actually been radicalized, and when they explain their reasons, the reasons contain oppression. So they will mention, you know, Muslims are oppressed, they're being bombed, they're being attacked. that comes up. But we have to acknowledge and also look at the other reasons that they stayed. You know, they say, why would I, like, for instance, even people who have left the United States or Canada or Australia, this is in their statements. They've said, you know, I could have been there and had the best materialistic, you know, pleasures ever. I could have had the best that life had to give me, you know, from a materialistic standpoint. But so what? What I want to do is I want to, you know, I want to be a martyr in the eyes of God. I want the afterlife, you know, and what the afterlife has to give me, not what this life has to provide. And so there's a lot of also ideological, you know, reasons, religiously speaking, you know, religious ideology that motivates these individuals to go out there and to take immense risks and to participate in these wars and these battles that give them a sense of glory and a sense of purpose. And for many, it can be very intoxicating and it can fill in that void, but it's a very, very sick and twisted kind of mindset, really.
Finally, this week also marked the 20th anniversary of the Oklahoma City bombing, which remains the most, the worst domestic terrorist act in U.S. history. Far more people killed than the Boston Marathon bombing, 168 people killed. Can we see parallels to the radical ideology driving Timothy McVeigh and Dzhokhar Tsarnaev? In the one case, political ideology, perhaps, and in the other case, religious.
Absolutely, 100% true. You know, in one case, it's a political ideology. In the case of Timothy McVeigh, was white supremacism. You know, photocopies of the white supremacist novel, I believe it was called The Turner Diaries. It was a novel that he read over and over again, and that had a fictional account of, you know, government, U.S. government buildings being blown up. You know, he was very inspired by that novel. It's a white supremacist novel. And then, of course, you have, you know, somebody like Tsarnaev, who was, you know, through his brother and through online radicalization, was inspired by jihadist content and propaganda. So yes, absolutely. One is just, you know, political ideology. The other one tends to be religious ideology. And there are parallels. And their personal reasons and, you know, the external reasons. Both of these individuals were vulnerable, you know, had a lot of social issues that they were going through, which made them very susceptible to becoming radicalized and doing such heinous things.
Well, I want to thank you so much, Amer, for joining us today and for shedding some light on these issues.
Thank you very much for having me. Appreciate it. Thank you.
My guest is Amer A. Nasser. He's a writer and educator, and his book is My Islam, How Fundamentalism Stole My Mind and Doubt Freed My Soul. He wrote an article that was widely read last year called ISIS Isn't the Real Enemy, The Game of Thrones Medieval Mindset That Birthed It Is, and we'll post that to our website at uprisingwithsonali.com later today. This is Uprising. We'll be right back.